Hashem, midol amen, namitam pasad pugit nuser
nuser. You are listening to KRFP Radio Free Moscow. This is the Wild Clear Water Country.
Yeah.
Welcome back to KRFP Radio Free Moscow. It's the Wild Clear Water Country show. Following up the great and excellent Nancy Casey and the Words and Music show. And just to follow up on her announcement about some friends coming from Matanwa to Moscow. In a couple of weeks, we're going to be doing a special show with those folks and having a two-hour special combined forces of the Wild Clearwater Country and the Words and Music show and get to talk with Abner and Afalyn, and get to hear some live Haitian Creole with some interpretation. It should be pretty fun, James.
It sounds like an excellent opportunity to meet new people.
That's right. So today's show, quick couple announcements. Starting tomorrow, going on for, I believe, a month or so, local chapter of the Audubon Society, Palouse Audubon, will be hosting Phillips Farm morning field trips. Phillips Farm is a little county park just north of town. Folks will be meeting at Rose Hours at 7 a.m. to head up to look for fall migrants and other birds. The least flycatcher, if you're a bird person, there's a least flycatcher first seen in the Phillips Farm area, I believe, back in early June, which is kind of interesting. They're not usually seen this far to the west. We're a little bit south and west of their normal range. They're an Impidanax flycatcher, one of those really hard to identify flycatchers, but you know they're different because their song's different. And there's a least flycatcher, and it's been seen throughout the whole summer. Don't know if there were two, so don't know if any breeding occurred, but kind of an interesting note. So folks will be heading up there at 7 a.m. tomorrow. August 23rd, I believe it's a Wednesday evening, 7 p.m. at the University Inn, Best Western Silver Room. Senator Larry Craig will be in town. He'll be taking public comment. This is a town hall meeting. So it's not restricted to one issue or one topic. If you have something you'd like to share with the senator, we encourage you to show up. Again, that's August 23rd. Well, it's getting warm out there again, and we're going to be talking about fire a bit today. We're going to be talking about some individual organisms that have a definite dependence in relationship with fire. White bark pine tree and a species that is crucial to the white bark pine's survival. We're going to be talking about Clark's Nutcracker. And, of course, we'll have the Whopper of the Week, which goes to the deserving individual who made one of the most egregious claims during the past week in the natural resource world. That's the Whopper of the Week. All right. Well, just to start the show off, I'm going to talk a little bit about Clark's Nutcracker and about white bark pine. Clark's Nutcracker is a corvid. It's a really interesting species. Corvids, those species that are considered commonly in the crow, raven, or jay grouping, corvids are some of the most intelligent birds. And most often noted that they're remarkably opportunistic. If you know crows or ravens or in this part of the country Steller's jays or western scrub jays, these birds are often the most successful around, the most comfortable with adapting to human altered landscapes. Ravens not as much, but crows most definitely. If you look at your backyard birds, corvids are often the top of the list for those that are comfortable in living and finding food, available food in those places. Clark's Nutcracker is a little bit different. It's usually a higher elevation species, and it's very dependent on the seeds of the white-barked pine. And the white-barked pine is an interesting pine. It's called a stone pine, a subalpine stone pine, because it's found in subalpine regions pretty high up. And it's a stone pine, one of five stone pines worldwide. It's the only one in North America. And the definition of a stone pine would be a pine that has wingless seeds and also has a cone that does not open on its own. So white-barked pine is one of those pines. Some interesting research has been done on the relationship between these two species, noting one interesting thing I thought. And white-barked pine seeds are also favorites of other species, including brown bears and other mammals. It's a highly nutritious seed, and these wingless seeds, if you've ever cracked open a pine cone or just reached in between the scales of an open pine cone and popped a seed out, they're relatively small. I mean, they're very small seeds. Majority of them are winged. They have a thin membrane surrounding the seed itself, which allows them to be dispersed by the wind, blown out of the cone and blown to another location, hopefully to grow into a seedling. These seeds are very light, of course, because they're windborne. The white-barked pine seeds are incredibly large in comparison, and most of the stone pine seeds are incredibly large in comparison, which makes sense that it would be a food source, a nutritious food source for species such as the Clark's Nutcracker. Well, there was an interesting symposium. I'm going to be taking some of my notes today from a really excellent resource, proceedings from an international workshop on subalpine stone pines, which took place in Switzerland a few years back. And one of the papers talks about the ecological relationships between Clark's Nutcracker and these wingless seeded pines, and they call them strobus pines. Oh, one other characteristic I forgot to mention about these stone pines is that their needles are in fascicles of five. That's what they call that little bundle, the fascicle. And the cones, just in case you're a jargon buff and you like this stuff, cones that don't open when they are mature are called indehiscent. So the indehiscent cones of the five needled pine, and it's a strobus pine. It's considered to be a subfamily grouping or a subspecies grouping, a strobus. The white pines all have five needles in a bundle. Wow. And just to tell you the difference in weights here for those seeds, the mean weight of the four strobus pines, including the white-barked pine we're talking about today, are about 0.27 grams per seed in comparison to the wind-dispersed pinus pines, about a third of that, and then the wind-dispersed strobus pines, which are about a sixth of that. And a couple interesting notes here on Clark's Nutcracker. And a lot of research has gone into dispersal of seeds, especially by birds. A lot of work on blue jays back in the east, and oaks. And here in the west, Clark's Nutcracker is kind of a great example for scientists to look into. And another reason jays are considered to be among the most intelligent of birds is their ability to, quote unquote, just to use the scientific, we don't want to anthropomorphize too much here and call them remembering, even though I really don't have a problem with that. They remember. And these nutcrackers can remember thousands of locations where they cache these pine seeds starting in mid-August.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. They can carry up to 150 of these seeds in there. They call this special sublingual pouch, which is a sac that's formed by the floor of the mouth and opens under the tongue. They cram these seeds into this sublingual pouch, up to 150 of them, and they can remember the location of these seeds, their seed caches, for more than 9 months after cashing them. So pretty remarkable. And a couple of signs, if you're out there and looking, how would you know if a tree or if a cone of a white bark pine had been used by Clark's Nutcracker? Because I think often we miss out on things because we can't interpret them correctly. And so if you see a cone out there that's got some exposed areas that looked like a sharp point's been jabbed into it, and it's a little brown around this area, and the rest of the cone is still green. Very possible that a Clark's Nutcracker has gotten into that unripe cone. And they have trouble getting the seeds out when the cones are still unripe, but they usually only get parts of seeds. But after the cones mature and ripen and dry out, the Clark's Nutcracker uses them almost primarily as a food source. And like I said, begin caching in mid-August in the Northern Rockies. And when compared to a lot of these other stone pines, the subalpine, or excuse me, the white bark pine is one of the preferential pines. So if you go to places where you have more than one of these species, where their ranges overlap, not so much where we are. We really have mostly Pinus albicaulis, the white bark pine where we are. But if you go down to northern Utah and northern New Mexico, down into California, you'll have a limber pine and some others as well in the lower elevations. And the Clark's Nutcracker tends to choose the white bark pine over limber pine. So an interesting ecological relationship here, and I haven't read anything about concerns over Clark Nutcracker populations, but I have read some concerns about white bark pine and blister rust, white pine blister rust, and the mountain pine beetle being two of the big agents in decreasing numbers and health of white bark pines in the Northern Rockies. And some folks speculate, the jury's still out, the research. Some folks think that fire suppression might have something to do with it as well, though most fire ecologists think that the areas where white bark pine are found only burn every 300 years or so. And so fire suppression, not really a factor there. But it is possible, and the jury is still out. And like James and I were talking about earlier, another factor here, which is believed to be a cause of the increase in mountain pine beetle in the West by some, is global climate change. And it throws a lot of scientific research off and really has to be considered when any, especially wide-scale ecological relationships are being investigated. You really have to take into account, if you're talking over a period of years, you really have to think about global climate change and the impact, especially immediately on vegetation. Yeah, interesting stuff. I was reading an article today also which made me think of the white bark pine. There's a fire on the eastern edge of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, the Gash Creek Fire in Montana, and it's become a high elevation fire over there in the wilderness moving west, and it's burning up a lot of those dead and dying white bark pines. So maybe this is the fire they haven't seen for 300 years. Who knows?
Is that the fire that it's south of Victor that we were talking about earlier this week?
Yeah, that's right.
That's the fire I seen come into Idaho on Saturday when I was atop Green Mountain.
Okay.
That was something to see.
I bet. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't spent much time in western Montana, but I do know another interesting note about this fire in Gash Creek, which has moved to Sweathouse Creek, is that the forest supervisor over there has allowed them to use mechanized equipment in fighting this fire in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. So, I just got that news today. They've allowed limited use of chainsaws, helicopters, and a couple other mechanical means to fight this fire for whatever reason. We'll get more to that story probably next week. We'll get to the bottom of that and see why the forest supervisor over there thought it was okay to go ahead and make that sacrifice. But Yeah, this is that time of year. I heard today that several fires just got started up around Powell last night.
Wow, that was a pretty strong lightning storm that went rolling through.
Yeah, it was. It would have been nice to see a little more rain out of it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. I was traveling up from Lapway and just seeing some pretty solid strikes, and there was just not very much moisture along with it. Kept my mother and my brothers very busy fighting urban interface fires down in Lapway, surrounded communities.
Yeah. Now, that Kirby fire down there on the main stem Clearwater has been pretty much contained, if I remember correctly. How are any of these fires of size in and around Lapway?
It didn't seem like it got very big, but it was very close to a lot of homes, and so it was pretty tense there for a little while, from what I understand.
Well, we're going to be back, and we're going to talk more about Clark's Nutcracker a little bit. We're going to talk about fire, so stay tuned for more Wild Clearwater Country. Thanks for joining us. Welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. We're talking about fire and Clark's Nutcracker, White Bark Pine. And I think what this is what it's all about to me is these kind of relationships. I think they're fascinating, and I think that's what really can tie people to a place is seeing some kind of interaction between species they hadn't seen before, realizing that all these organisms really are interrelated in some way, especially when you have this, you know, kind of blindingly obvious relationship like the one between the Clark's Nutcracker and White Bark Pine. They really, really need each other. And the brown bear, too. Brown bears really rely on White Bark Pine in the Northern Rockies, too. A little more kind of interesting information about Clark's Nutcracker. The history, great resource if you're interested in birds in Idaho, is Birds of Idaho by Thomas Burley. And it's become a little bit dated now, but it's still a fantastic resource, 1972, and some great old photographs. But one thing I love about these older resources is the anecdotes included. They have some really interesting anecdotal information in colorful language, and I think it really does the species benefit when the observer is allowed to be a little more than simply quantitative. Clark's Nutcracker is one of those species that was first described in science, in the scientific literature, by Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. And the type specimen, if you know museums and how museums work, they have a type specimen for every species out there. And that's the one they base, it's kind of the baseline species. And the one that is used for Clark's Nutcracker was an individual shot by Meriwether Lewis on May 28, 1806. And it was 2 miles north of Kamiai. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah, it's a couple hundred-year-old type specimen sitting in some museum, probably Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C., I would guess. Kind of a historical note on Clark's Nutcracker, though, and I have heard, I haven't seen many around here, but I don't know if you have, James, but I have heard that they occasionally erupt. And erupt meaning in mass, flying somewhere to find a better food source, which is a behavior commonly associated with finches, crossbills, red poles, and a lot of those northern finches often erupt further south than they're usually found in winters, where the cone crop isn't very, very, I guess, isn't good enough in northern Canada. They'll come even down into south of the Rockies occasionally, and Clark's Nutcracker is more of an elevational migrant, but they have been known to, they've been seen in mass down in near Winchester and down along the Clearwater too, in bad cone crop years. And just to give you an idea of the kind of stashing that these guys do, lots of research has been done, and when you're estimating amount of seeds cached by an individual bird, you gotta wonder how accurate can you really be. But some of the researchers doing this work have estimated that an individual Clark's Nutcracker can stash up to 50,000 white bark pine seeds in a season.
Wow.
And one interesting detail that all these researchers agreed on is that the white bark, or the Clark's Nutcracker, seem to stash at least twice as many seeds as it would need in a given season. Knowing, I'll use that quote unquote, knowing that there's going to be a loss to rodents, there's going to be a loss to weather, and there's going to be a loss on those caches that the individual bird just doesn't find again. And so they seem to take into account in their hunting and gathering there that they're going to need quite a bit more than just the bare minimum. And when I say caching, you might think of acorn woodpeckers in California or somewhere else in the Southwest, and you know their caches are pretty obvious. They'll take those big acorns and chink away holes in a large Coulter pine or Jeffrey pine, and you'll just see this pine tree riddled with acorns. And they'll come back and pull them out and crack them open and eat them at a later date. The caches that nutcrackers use are usually in the ground. They'll usually bury the seeds under a couple centimeters of either forest duff or gravel or mineral soil, and come back to that site at a later date to eat. And they say a cache is anywhere from around 1 to 15 seeds, so they just have thousands of these caches all over the place. Pretty remarkable.
And they remember where they are. So
yeah.
It is remarkable.
It is. Yeah, exactly. So just one of those neat species and one of those neat relationships in the Clearwater. And a species of concern, the whitebark pine. Not doing too well because of white pine blister rust and mountain pine beetle. And so maybe some of these big fires will be a help to these whitebark pines in the long term. Hopefully the mountain pine beetle, which they're calling an epidemic, some of the... I think it's a little bit of extreme language use calling it an epidemic, but they have been noted, the populations of mountain pine beetle, a lot higher than usual, which definitely can lead to some forest fires, but I think a lot of these fires are necessary. A lot of areas that have been suppressed for a long time, so. Good stuff. Now, James, you were just saying that your family, your brothers and your mom are out there fighting fires right now.
Yeah.
And you spent some time fighting fires in this area not too distant past.
Well, it seems a lot longer. It's over 10 years ago. But
okay.
Yeah, I was a wildland firefighter when I was in the business and fought some fires up on the North Fork of the Clearwater, South Fork of the Clearwater, the Salmon River area. So, yeah, I've hit a few fires in the area.
Okay. What were the fires on the North Fork? Where exactly were they? Or maybe you could just share with us, share with the audience out there a little bit about the day in the life of a wildland firefighter, and just maybe any things that you remember specifically or that caught your attention that you noticed about how fire behaves or how it behaves in a certain ecosystem.
Sure. I've been to a few places, like in North Fork Clearwater. It was a place called Long Meadows. I think it's on the opposite side of the river from Aquarius,
okay.
Way up at the top up there. And, I haven't been back to there, but I've been back to a few other places where I've fought fire, like Earthquake Meadows, Earthquake Basin. And it seems like the vegetation is more plush. The area seems healthy. I mean, when we first went through there, you know, it looked horrible. It was black and charred, and, you know, you'd think it'd remain that way. But, you know, in just a sheer few short years, it would be back and even better than before. So I guess overall, I have mixed feelings about firefighting. I loved fighting them. It was fun being out there in the wilderness, getting up at 5:30 in the morning and working long 12 to 18-hour days or sometimes all night to keep something in check. Got plenty dirty, you know, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. It was a great way to learn areas way back in the wilderness areas or in the national forest lands where they were fighting them, to be out there with the land and experience that type of a occupation. Like I say, my mother and all my brothers still fight fire. Mostly they do the urban interface stuff with similar to what Idaho Department of Lands does, that type of a fire suppression. But yeah, it's a great occupation, but I hope that they'd utilize more let it burn policies out there. I really do.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of first-hand experience with fire. My dad was a volunteer fireman where I grew up in rural northwestern Virginia, up there right next to the West Virginia state line. It's pretty wild country for back east, and I do know that it's just a hallmark of the West, you know, as a transplant, not growing up here. One of the distinct differences I immediately noticed when moving to the West was the difference in air moisture, which I didn't like and I liked at the same time. I had a few nosebleeds and really dried out. I felt really dried out and had to drink a lot of water my first few months when we moved here. But I tell you what, the summers are pretty nice, and it's interesting. I think it's really neat that fire can still operate, and it's been a natural process. It's been happening for thousands of years, and it's still it's such a crucial part of an ecosystem. In the Western forest ecosystems, fire is crucial. And, you know, like I said earlier, the researchers think that whitebark pine's on a 300-year cycle. And but fire is such an elusive thing, and most of the fire ecologists will readily admit that their knowledge is transient and good for a certain period of time and a certain location at best, because it's so dynamic and ecosystems are so dynamic and not static at all. But you know, these pine ecosystems, whether it's the whitebark pine in the subalpine regions or down lower, like on the South Fork and the Ponderosa and Lodgepoles, all those conifer ecosystems depend on fire. And a lot of the species there do, too. And just another note about whitebark pines is that they're a favorite perch spot for blue grouse, which is one of the forest game birds in the region. And a species that is, some folks who know about bird population dynamics are a little bit concerned about blue grouse. They've seen a little bit of a downward trend the last few years. So just another interesting creature of the Clearwater that we'll probably be talking about in subsequent weeks. We're going to go to another musical break, and we're going to come back. We're going to have the Whopper of the Week and more. Thanks for joining us.
Meanwhile, back in the year one, when you belonged to no one, you didn't stand a chance, son, if your pens were undone. 'Cause you were brave for humanity and sold to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day, a million generations removed from expectations of a being who you really want to be. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of a new day. Hey, 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 hey. So as you push off from the shore, won't you turn your head once more and make your peace with everyone? But those who choose to stay will live just one more day to do the things they should have done. And as you cross the wilderness, suspending in your emptiness, you do have to pray. Looking for a sign that the universal mind has written you into the passion play. Skating away, skating away, skating away. The thin eyes of a new day. Hey, 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 hey. And as you cross the circle line, well, the eyes will greet behind. You're a rabbit on the run. And the silver splendors fly in the corner of your eye, shining in the setting sun. Well, do you ever get the feeling that the story's too damn real and in the present tense? All and everybody's on the
saving, and it seems like you're the only person sitting in the audience. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin eyes of the new day.
Jethro Tull for you. Welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. Well, it's about that time of the show, James, where we get to hand over. Well, last week I think we gave a nice. No, did we give a Whopper last week, or did we give an elk burger to somebody?
We did an elk Whopper of the week for the Forest Service and their management.
That's right.
Yeah.
The Salmon River.
Yeah.
The log jam.
The big firecracker.
Peanut butter and jam sandwich over there, which we should have given them. So we got a Whopper this week, and yeah, well-deserving Whopper coming to some folks down in the valley for just some poor reporting. The Lewiston Tribune receives this week's Whopper, you know, a big fat, you know, rainforest beef burger with, you know, with fake cheese and mayonnaise, you know, the whole schmear. These guys, you get it good. And the reason we're giving it to them this week is because they're just coming out with some ridiculous opinion pieces and most recently an article about a access summit in Orofino coming up Friday. There's a group called Play, which is public land access year round, and they're basically want to be able to drive their four wheelers anywhere they feel like it in public lands, including wilderness. And they're having an access summit, and they're doing this access summit because they want a big snowmobile trail running from down starting in Elk City all the way up to Wallace.
Wow.
And the word on the street is that they really don't want to open any trails. They are supposedly going they want to keep this trail on roads, roaded areas, whether closed or open. They say they're not going to, they don't want to open trails. So they're trying to, I guess, assuage some of the environmentalists and folks that are concerned about increasing ORV use in public lands by coming up with this proposal. I don't know how much legitimacy is to that report, but that's what they say they want to do. Anyway, Eric Barker, the Tribune, covered this story, and just in his introductory statements and in his title, he's basically advertising this initiative for the organization. He talked about carving out more playroom in the title of his. And this is supposed to be objective journalism. So for that piece and for their editorial stance on CEDRA, the Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act, which opens up about 7,000 acres to trophy home development down there around Stanley, and for the opinions that wilderness shouldn't be wilderness, and this week's Whopper goes to the Lewiston Tribune. All right, yeah, Jim Fisher, yeah. Tom Henderson. And it's unfortunate. Actually, I've really been impressed lately with the Moscow Pullman Daily News' outdoor section, which is it's a lot shorter, but it has some fantastic information. I think they're doing a really good job, and they seem to have a little more breadth of issues to discuss and to talk on. The Tribune seems to get caught up in elk and ORVs and dams quite often, and that seems to be where they triangulate. So we'd like to see a little more breadth from down there.
Well,
there we go. A little technical difficulty. Sorry for that. We're talking about fire, and I was talking to James off the air just a minute ago on a musical break, just asking him about how firefighting works, and we're just talking about some of the places he's been to fight fires down there on the South Fork. And so just to ask a couple of those questions again, James, because my knowledge of firefighting is really is really pretty small. Now, you're saying the crews consist of up 40 people or more. Is 40 a small crew? Or?
A fire crew is actually 20-man crew.
Okay.
A strike team is 40-man crew. And so that's pretty much how they base their crew sizes from that.
Okay. And we were talking about the idea of digging fire lines and what digging fire lines does to slow down or stop a fire. And you were mentioning to me that there's a guy who really knows the terrain well who heads out with flagging to flag an area where a line's to be dug, and the line is dug in order to, the goal is to keep the fire from spreading across that line, so stopping it from spreading on the ground.
Yeah.
In that way. Okay. And I guess it depends on the situation. I guess a lot of it is fire by fire, because each one is different, but are there any set rules for some of the tools that you use to fight fires? There's fire lines, and there's helicopters or planes bring in fire retardant or water. Maybe you could give us a little hypothetical fire situation and how a fire crew might react to it. Something like one of the fires down, like the Kirby fire down on the Clearwater this past week. I think it was about 500 acres, and we saw a lot of fire crews down there in a helicopter in a field. How often or how quickly does a crew get in there and start getting their work underway after a fire starts?
You know, that far out of like a traditional forest setting, it was very fast because there's a lot of homes and such like that were near at hand. In some places out in the wilderness, from what I understand, the Forest Service District may choose to let some burn, while others in different areas with different uses, I guess, to apply to it, they will send their smoke jumpers or their strike teams in there lickety-split, so to speak. Conditions, like you said, are just based on fire by fire, the conditions that they have. You know, if it's too steep a country and there's not adequate safety precautions, they may elect to go strictly with air support of helicopters and planes. Other times, it may be that the vegetation of the forest canopy and things allow for strictly hand crews to go in there and circle it with just a hand line. So you're right. Sometimes they bring in pumper slugs for water suppression via, a traditional fire engine type mechanism.
Okay.
Made just for wildland suppression. So, yeah, there's a lot of different circumstances that are surrounded.
When would a smoke jumper be used, and what is their role?
Smoke jumpers, like I say, you know, there's different situations for them. I'm sure that there's timber stands that Forest Service would rather have for, like, if they have identified those stands for logging, or if they have trails on them, you know, they may fly their smoke jumpers in to jump in there and get a jump on, especially if there's a lot of small fires that usually ensue or follow a thunderstorm. You know, way out there in the wilderness, there's usually a lot of spot fire. So a smoke jumper at that time would be called in to go and hit the ones that look like they're growing fast or have potential to become huge events. So they're like really an initial attack mechanism to get in there fast with minimal supervision, with a lot of education and experience.
Now, what would their work consist of? Not being able to haul a whole bunch of gear with you, parachuting out of a plane, what would a smoke jumper be able to accomplish? How would they accomplish their goal?
Well, they're like a small unit of a strike team or a normal fire crew. They have all the tools that a full crew would have, but they only have 10 people on it usually.
Okay.
And so their fire lines are usually a little smaller, or if they are you going to utilize some fire to fight the fire, you know, do some back burning, things like that, they'll have all that tools with them, or it'll be dropped along with them in a separate parachute. So they have their ways of getting materials into them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Back burning an area so a fire can't spread through that area?
Yeah, taking its full feel from it.
Okay.
Yeah, they'll like dig a line and then burn right next to the line and slowly move further away with that fire until they got a big burnt swath that will hinder the fire's movement.
So, and that the diesel drip torches, is that what most folks use?
Yeah, okay. And I've seen those in action. Even last night, they were utilizing some of those. I've seen those in the urban interface, saving whole housing units, you know. So that's a very effective fire suppression tool, is fighting fire with fire.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's quite a few fires going now. This seems to be the time of year. I guess mid to late July, things get started.
It's dry out there right now.
Yeah,
it's
dry. Isn't it?
Yeah. So things are just going up quick.
Yeah, a lot of places probably need a good burn.
Yeah, like I say, I'm a proponent of fire as a management tool and forest service repertoire. I wish it would be more widely used. You know, I mean, there can't be any harm in it besides the harm to those that make their money from the logs. And so it's time the Forest Service should really look at amending their philosophies. I mean, it's a changing world, and those old philosophies ain't going to work when we start experiencing what you touched upon earlier as a global climate change and what those ramifications are going to have on those unique and fragile ecosystems.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. In those areas that aren't close to a population center, that is really the only, I think, concern by the industry, that they're losing valuable logs. And there's a letter to the editor in Sunday's paper from Bill Mulligan, asking why the Forest Service hasn't put out the Bar Creek fire, which is over there on the east side of Pot Mountain, which they're letting it burn in certain areas because it's a pretty sizable roadless area there. And his concern, of course, was for the bored feet, which I think the nutrients return to the soil there. And the wildlife habitat that snags provide, I think, is incredibly much more valuable than a few thousand board feet. And, you know, it's something we've talked about in the show before. We've talked about commodification and how monetarily how valuable these ecosystem processes are, and the reluctance on a lot of people to quantify those things because it can set up a kind of a bit of a conflict when you place a monetary value on something, and then it sets it up to be compromised in the future if something else is to be proven more valuable. And you know, it's not really to base our decisions on for those reasons, period.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's enough forest right now that's being managed for the logging potential. You know, why do we need to look at areas, like you said, that are roadless, that, you know, there's really no avenue for a market right now, and we don't want that. So, you know, that we have enough forests that are being managed for logs that are set up for that, as much as we hate to see it. So let's keep that business where it is and keep the roadless area roadless.
Yeah. Yeah, and Oregon just made their first sale. The first roadless area went for sale over in the Biscuit Fire area. It went for over $1.5 million. I believe it was the Mike Gulch sale, but I can't remember. The same company that had been involved there already purchased this chunk of roadless land to be salvage logged. And the research out there really shows that is the worst time to log an area. The soil's so sensitive. The pulse erosion disturbance is so strong. You can really damage a watershed by going in and logging after a big fire. There's just nothing to hold that soil back. You know, all the undercover is gone, and a lot of the roots aren't sucking water.
Yeah, it just really goes to show where the priorities are. You know, I mean, they want to rush in there because the logs are going to lose their quality over the next year, and they don't want to have a low-quality timber, so they negotiate the other intrinsic values of the soil and water health for hurrying up and getting in there for money.
Yeah, and I've talked to several people who, for their living, make products out of wood and have made their niche market salvage logs. They've gone in and taken down timber that's been there for, you know, and sometimes years, especially cedar. It takes so long to deteriorate, and just cut that bark off and the outer layer and had perfectly salvageable wood underneath. That was, you know, beautiful stuff. And good for making furniture or, you know, for other items too. So I think that's an underutilized market too. I think it just goes to show that commercial industry has no place in public lands. Once you commercialize an idea or a concept or an item, you're really kind of corrupting and opening it up for corporate interests to kind of take advantage of. And so... with that, I think we're going to go into a little bit more music here, we only have a couple minutes left of the show, so we thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, listeners.
Yeah. We're going to also stay tuned because, Between the Lines is coming up next, and, we hope you join us in the Wild Clearwater Country again. If you would like to tune in via streaming audio, you can tune in at www.krfp.org.